appeals. We have one case on our docket. We have experienced counsel. Does either of you have any questions on our procedures? If anyone in the audience has a cell phone or pager, we would appreciate your turning it off so the attorneys aren't interrupted. Otherwise, we're ready for our argument, People versus Haley.
May it please the court. Tom Carberry, number 19707, appearing for Mr. Haley. I want to point out that the most important thing here is that we're not asking the court to decide legal issues. The issue here is, did we present enough evidence in the 35C motion to get a hearing? And that's a low standard. Under People Against Ardolino and White Against Denver District Court, basically, if a defendant alleges facts that should grant a hearing, he should get a hearing, unless the files in the case and the transcripts show that he shouldn't. But in this case, the files and the transcripts can't show most of what was alleged in this hearing. The first issue, Mr. Haley alleges that the Denver District Attorney engaged in a pattern of racial discrimination in habitual offender cases.
Okay, did your allegations point to any similarly situated Caucasian defendant who was not prosecuted on habitual counts?
I have two answers to that, Judge Webb. First, it pointed to one, to Mr. Allen. He was the only white man during that three-year period charged with the habitual offender and convicted of it. No, we did not for the rest, but as was pointed out in the briefs, in the federal case of Marshall against Columbia Hospital, they held that that's not the issue in getting the hearing. The issue in getting the hearing, and that's what the issue was in Marshall, and the circuit court remanded for a hearing, was that you just had to allege enough facts. Now, if we have a hearing, we'll be able to present witnesses, and we'll be able to subpoena records, and we'll be able to show that during this period that there were many dozens, perhaps hundreds of white people similarly situated that were habitual offender eligible in drug cases and did not get charged.
Okay, but can you point to me in your 35C where specifically that was alleged?
It wasn't. Judge, what was alleged was that there were only 10 people charged with the habitual offender in Denver during this three-year period. Eight of them were black, one was Hispanic, one was white. The level of evidence that we have to prevent is very low. In racial discrimination cases, all it is prima facie. That basically means we just have to present some evidence. Here, the district attorney didn't even respond to our allegations. Judge, racial discrimination is a scourge. The United States Supreme Court in Miller L., which is a case just from 3 years or 4 years ago, 2005, said that racial discrimination by prosecutions is one of the worst things that possibly can happen in the criminal justice system. So if we have racial discrimination going in the Denver District Attorney's Office, Mr. Haley should have a right to prove that. And the only way he's ever going to be able to prove that is in a motion. We can't prove everything in a motion. We just have to allege facts. Then, as to the second issue, again, the Colorado Supreme Court has said that a pattern of prosecutorial misconduct will not be tolerated. Here, this prosecutor, Mr. Twining, has done this in Mr. Haley's case. You know, I know that we raised this on direct appeal, and the Court of Appeals and the district court judge had held that under Harper, that after polling the jury, that was okay. But that's not the issue here. The issue here is that Mr. Twining has done it at least once before. And does that make his conduct deliberate? We would be able to show that in the case of Kenneth Garcia, he did almost the exact same thing during jury selection. This is deliberately prejudicing the jury. And I have I can't show it because it's not in a hearing. We have a third case where this same prosecutor did a similar thing.
All right, a couple questions, please. Why isn't this issue foreclosed under res judicata or collateral estoppel principles, because it was raised on direct appeal and found not meritorious?
It wasn't raised on direct appeal, Judge Webb. What was raised on direct appeal, that this prosecutor had done it once, in this case, it was a sole instance. This is a completely separate issue.
All right, but how can you get relief by making a different argument when you didn't get relief making the direct argument?
Because the first argument is, it's, you're able to overlook it. It might be inadvertent by the prosecutor that the judge saw this, looked at it, didn't find deliberate misconduct. But when you have more than one instance of the prosecutor doing the same thing, this is misconduct. This is deliberately trying to subvert the jury process.
Okay, the other case you referred to predated Mr. Haley's trial.
That's right.
So therefore, it could have been raised. You could therefore, at least in theory, the willful misconduct pattern argument could have been raised on direct appeal.
Only if somebody had found it.
Well, and did you allege in this motion that you could not have discovered the earlier case by reasonable diligence? I'm not arguing with you. Did you make newly discovered evidence reasonable diligence allegations in this motion?
I did not allege that, Judge. But if that's the case, then I'm ineffective, and that's a consecutive 35C on this, because here just the statement of it says we've got new evidence that could not have been raised in direct appeal, Judge, because it was not presented at the trial court. In direct appeal, you're only allowed to raise what was in the record. No one could raise that in direct appeal, so it couldn't be done.
Okay, and are you saying that even though on direct appeal the trial court found no prejudice, that analysis would come out differently if there was evidence that the prosecutor had done it deliberately rather than inadvertently?
That's correct.
Because, why is that?
Because under the Colorado Supreme Court's jurisprudence, People Against Lee, which I cited in my brief, they held that a repeated pattern of prosecutorial misconduct will not be tolerated. And in that case, they reversed the defendant's conviction and remanded for a new trial, because they held that the prosecutor in the 4th Judicial District had done the same type of misconduct before, and they weren't going to tolerate it.
But wasn't that the first occasion on which the issue had been addressed in the Lee case?
Yes,
and this is... There wasn't a prior appeal saying that there was no harm here.
No, but there had been prior appeals saying that prosecutor had committed misconduct. And this was a new appeal saying this prosecutor was now doing the same misconduct. And the Supreme Court said, well, we're not going to deal. We're not going to tolerate that. We've had you up here before, and we didn't reverse. We've got you up here a second time. You're doing the same stuff. We're reversing. That's what they said.
Okay.
That's the issue. Now, as to this issue of eavesdropping.
Wait, Mr. Carberry. So
yes,
you're asking us to reverse this conviction even though there's a finding of no prejudice to Mr. Haley?
No, that's not, Judge Richmond, what I'm asking. What I'm asking for you to do is reverse the trial court's order denying a hearing and remand for a hearing. That's all we want, because the record is inadequate at this point. We would present a tremendous amount more evidence of the prejudice that has happened here as to all these issues, not just to this prosecutorial misconduct.
Well, I'm just talking about this issue. On this issue, this court has found that the effect at Mr. Haley's trial was that there was no prejudice because of the way the judge handled the situation.
Yes.
There might have been prejudice in Mr. Garcia's case, but obviously you're not going to try to raise that in Mr. Haley if there was a Rule 35 remand. So I don't understand what the point is of remanding it for a hearing or otherwise if there's already been a finding in this case that there was no prejudice to Mr. Haley as a result of the alleged conduct.
Judge Richmond, that's because a lot of people don't understand this in the criminal law. The issue is the supervisory power of the courts. The Colorado Supreme Court has supervisory power over all matters in the courts. And the Colorado Supreme Court has exercised this supervisory power to say that we're not going to tolerate prosecutorial misconduct. We're not in Lee, they didn't look at the prejudice that this particular defendant incurred. What they looked at was the pattern of the prosecutor's misconduct, and they said, this is not going to happen in our courts. We're going to reverse. You do this once, and it may not be prejudicial. You do it more than once, we're not looking at prejudice. We're not tolerating it.
So you're seeking the sanction of the prosecution. That's what
we're seeking, reversal of the conviction as a sanction of the prosecution. That's what happened in Lee. That's right.
And how, Mr. Carberry, how would that satisfy Strickland, the prejudice prong of Strickland?
Well, in this case, I'm not sure if this lawyer was ineffective by not finding Mr. Kenneth Garcia's case. Prejudice prong in Strickland, I've applied to a couple of the other factors here, but as far as this one, we didn't discover Mr. Garcia's situation until afterwards, when I was working on the appellate process here. And if I could briefly address a couple of things, as I see my time is quickly running out. As to the eavesdropping, this issue has never been addressed. The Attorney General, in their brief, argued consent, and because there is a part in Part 1 of Section 189.304, it says if one party consents. There's two problems with that. The major problem is that would vitiate 189.305 Subsection 4, which says the police always must get a court order, always. So they can't just get around the statute by saying, well, we'll have one police officer testify, and then we never have to go to a judge. We have one police officer participate. No case has addressed this. And then as the issue of...
Mr. Carberry, was the eavesdropping admitted, the eavesdropping evidence admitted at the trial?
Yes.
Was it raised on direct appeal?
I do not.
So why isn't it barred by Rule 35C37 or whatever provision says he can raise it in collateral?
Well, because under People Against Cagle and other Colorado Supreme Court cases, they say if an issue was not raised, if a constitutional issue was not raised in the trial court, you can't raise it on direct appeal. It's a giant conflict between Rule 35C and the Colorado Supreme Court holdings. But the other issue is... And then, of course, the other issue that you get to raise in 35C is ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, Judge Richman. So if you can always raise this under one method or other. It's either under Cagle, you're not allowed to raise it on a direct appeal, or if the appellate counsel didn't raise it on a direct appeal, then he was ineffective. And you have a constitutional right to effective assistance of appellate counsel. But then going to the question of reasonable expectation of privacy, this court has actually held in a wiretap case that I didn't cite in my brief that I missed and I found this morning and I've given the Attorney General a copy, People Against Leslie, L-E-S-S-L-I-E, 24 P3rd 22, Colorado Court of Appeals 2000, at page 28, and it's the last page. They held that the fact that the police concealed the listening device compels the conclusion that there was a reasonable expectation of privacy, that they hid it, because why would they hide it if a person didn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy? Because in this case, these people went off to a private place to conduct a drug transaction. And then, as to the other two issues, I know that courts allow police officers to break the law all the time, but 1818.405 says no person may do these acts, and it has exceptions. And it doesn't accept police officers. And we have to interpret the law as it's written. And we can't just have a judicially created rule where just because we live in a police state and we have police officers who do this stuff all the time, that they can do it in this case. No one's ever raised this issue. There are no cases on this. But we have a statute that bars police officers from doing it, bars all people from doing it. And as to the Curtis advisement, People Against Blem explicitly says you should get a 35C hearing to look at that, to look at the voluntariness. And here we have a mentally retarded, which we would show, illiterate man who's obviously confused during the Curtis advisement, very confused, as you can see from it. And he's not sure whether to testify or not, and the judge makes no clarification. And I'm asking this court to remand for a hearing in this case, because for 2 grams of cocaine, that's the total amount of cocaine Mr. Haley had in 4 cases, he got 48 years in prison. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chris Bosk, attorney registration number 39036, representing the people in this matter. I agree with opposing counsel about the law that we have to apply to this situation. Under 35C3, trial court must hold an evidentiary hearing unless the motion, the files, and the record clearly establish that the allegations are without merit. He doesn't have to present evidence in support of these allegations, but he does have to present facts that, if true, would provide a basis for relief. The trial court properly denied the motion without a hearing because defendant failed to allege facts that, if true, would provide a basis for relief. The first issue, alleging a pattern of racial discrimination and the filing of habitual charges, in support of this, the defendant offered a document from the Colorado Office of State Court Administrator. I won't go into the details. I think you understand what the document showed. Over a three-year period, one white, two Hispanic, and seven black people were charged with habitual counts. The second thing that was offered in support of this allegation of racial discrimination was counsel's own memory from his time as a public defender. Well, in order to show a pattern of racial discrimination, you have to show effect and intent. And these facts don't come anywhere near showing either of these.
Couldn't we, if the statistical disparity was enormous, couldn't intent be inferred from that?
There is case law that has inferred intent from, I believe the language is, a statistical proof presenting a stark pattern of racial disparity. But I would submit to this court that we don't have a pattern here, let alone a stark pattern of racial disparity. What we have is a document showing a three-year period and showing that a particular group of people is affected more than another group based upon the district attorney's prosecutorial decisions. And I cited a case in my brief that says specifically that that's not enough to show effect. I think the most important thing about the effect prong is that we don't know anything about the makeup of the population that is eligible for habitual criminal charges. And without that information, we can't know whether a person in a similarly situated position could have been but wasn't charged with an habitual count.
Isn't there a chicken-egg problem there, though? Because how can somebody in Mr. Haley's position, even though represented by able counsel, identify the baseline population of people, of all people who were eligible for habitual charges, without taking discovery? Yet you say he's not entitled to discovery because he didn't present anything about the baseline population.
Well, he presented what could be termed a study, an investigative report about the charges that were filed over a three-year period. I'm not sure why he couldn't have come with facts that would allege.
Okay. Are you aware of any publicly accessible database that would include the data that you claim Mr. Haley failed to present?
Well, I'm not aware of one, Your Honor, but it seems like the report that he submitted does go to that kind of information, and I can only speculate, but it seems like if that's available in the form that he submitted it, we could also find out, at least during a three-year period, what kind of people were subject to these charges.
But his point is that they weren't charged, so how are you going to find out? How is a report going to tell you about the people who weren't charged?
Well, by looking at who would be subject to the charges.
Okay, well, what kind of a report is going to tell us the racial mix of the people who were subject to habitual charges after having been arrested for drug offense?
I would have to admit that I'm not aware of any such report, Your Honor.
Well, let's assume for purposes of my question that there is no such report. How can he ever allege enough facts to entitle himself to a hearing without having some discovery? And that's why I said it seems like you're presenting a chicken and egg problem.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I think that the standard that we're presented with, that we have to operate within, requires that he allege facts sufficient to provide relief. And whether or not a study is available to him or a document is available to him, I don't think really vitiates the issue of failing to present those facts.
Are you familiar with the database that he searched?
I I'm not personally familiar with it, Your Honor.
I mean, if it shows people who are charged with drug offenses and their race, and whether they're also charged with habitual criminal offenses, I would think, although I'll ask him, whether it doesn't also show people who are charged with drug offenses and their race, and they're not charged with habitual criminal offenses, which is the data that he could have presented.
And you said it in a much better way than I was trying to express it, but that's what I was trying to say, is that this study that he presents suggests that the information that I think Judge Webb is looking for here would be available in that document or through further study of that database, although as I said, I can't say for sure.
That's why I asked if you were familiar with it, if you had looked at it.
I didn't, and I think the reason I didn't is because I think that the issue here is one of a very limited question, and that's whether he presented facts sufficient, and he didn't.
Is the database sufficiently identified in the record that we can locate it, and if we can we take judicial notice of it?
I believe that the database would be sufficiently identified. I don't see why one couldn't find that database, Your Honor. As far as judicial notice, it is a court record. I wasn't prepared to answer a judicial notice question, but my gut instinct would be that the court could take judicial notice of court records. With time slipping away, I'd like to address the second claim, a pattern of misconduct in trials. This court understands the basis of this claim, so I won't go into it. But the standard is that conduct is only prosecutorial misconduct if it's flagrantly, glaringly, or tremendously improper. Now, at trial, the prosecutor assured the court that it was inadvertent, leaving the file on the table was inadvertent. The defense counsel herself said, quote, "I have no belief that there was any intent on the part of the prosecutor to let the jury see the file," and the trial court agreed. Now, under the facts that we have available to us in this record, it's hard for me to see how this could be misconduct, let alone flagrant, glaring, or tremendously improper misconduct. And if we don't have misconduct here, then his assertion that the same thing happened in a previous case is, by nature, also not misconduct. Two zeros don't equal one. We don't have a pattern. Trial court properly rejected or denied this claim without a hearing.
So is there an implied claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel for making that conclusory statement?
Is there for trial counsel to say that she had no belief there was, I wouldn't think so, Your Honor. I think the facts of the record makes clear that this wasn't a situation of prosecutorial misconduct. There wasn't even a question or a hint of it, and so I would think that even if there were an implied assertion of prosecutorial ineffective assistance, that it wouldn't hold water. The violation of eavesdropping law, 18.9304 states rather clearly that when one of the principal parties to the conversation consents to being recorded, you don't have an eavesdropping situation. And that's exactly what we have here. The officer that was conducting the undercover buy with the defendant in this case consented to being recorded. He used a KEL kit, I believe, for the purposes of officer safety. I believe they didn't use this at trial, but that's beside the point. The point is that this is not eavesdropping, plain and simple. I appreciate counsel's passing along the People v. Leslie case. I don't think it applies because in that case, based on my quick reading of it anyway, there was not a principal party to the conversation that had consented to being recorded. And I think that that makes it inapplicable here. In terms of the fourth argument with respect to violation of 18.18.405 and the police officer's sale of drugs, it's hard to answer a question like this. There's so much case law that would suggest otherwise. I'd point to People in the Interest of MN, a Colorado Supreme Court case from 1988, 88, excuse me, which says that the infiltration of drug rings, including sale of drugs, is a recognized and permissible means of investigation. Now, there is case law out there that suggests that police conduct can be outrageous. It can be so outrageous and so shocking to the universal sense of justice that it might violate due process, but there's no evidence in the record, and to my memory, counsel didn't allege that this was such a case, and even if he did, it simply is not. Essentially, what he's asking the court to do is find that police can no longer engage in undercover drug buys, and I would rely on the hundreds of cases in which convictions were found based on those kind of activities, as well as this Colorado Supreme Court case.
Isn't this a claim that could have been raised on direct appeal?
I believe it is, Your Honor.
And will therefore be barred by Rule 35C, subsection 7?
That's correct. And
but you didn't argue that in your brief as to any of these claims.
Pardon me?
You didn't argue in your brief as to any of these claims that seemingly could have been raised on direct appeal, that they're barred by the Operation Rule 5, Rule 35C7. And I was wondering if I missed something because I didn't find it in your brief.
I may have overlooked that, Your Honor. You remind me to make a point about the second argument concerning relitigating a claim already raised. Prosecutorial misconduct was raised as a right to fair trial claim. It wasn't raised as a pattern claim, but I'm not really sure how we can draw that distinction. The last claim is the Curtis advisement. He claims that the trial court gave an erroneous advisement and that he erroneously found a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver. It's a 15-page advisement, which by itself suggests that the court went into quite a bit of detail and attempted on multiple occasions to clarify the defendant's rights when it appeared that he wasn't understanding them. I won't go into all the details of the Curtis advisement, but suffice to say that the five elements were met, and each one was met with an affirmative statement concerning defendant's understanding of the issue. Let's see, 2 minutes. Maybe I'll address this first one, in which the defendant asserts that he was confused and unable to understand the issue of prior felonies being introduced if he testified. I'll admit that the defendant's first summary of this area was a bit confusing. It wasn't as clear as it could have been, but the trial court immediately followed up by explaining it in clear, simple terms, to which the defendant responded, "So, just what I asked they could do." That suggests that the defendant understood the trial court's sort of summary of this right and that there was really no confusion about it. The rest of the claims concerning the notion that he didn't voluntarily give up his right to testify because there was language like kind of and I think so and I guess so, it doesn't suggest that he didn't understand. I think the trial court hit it on the nose when it said that, well, you may not be happy with the situation you're in. You may not be happy about what your counsel is advising you to do with respect to testifying or not, but that doesn't change the fact that he understood the rights as the trial court was explaining them to him and that he voluntarily waived his right to testify. And so with all five of these issues, the defendant did not present facts that, if true, would grant relief, and the trial court denied the motion without a hearing properly, and the people respectfully request that this court affirm that order. There are no further questions. I thank the court.
May it please the court. As to a pattern, the Supreme Court has said two can be a pattern in People Against Lee. Here we have eight black people, one white, two Hispanics shown. As to the state court administrative records, these were created by Chief Justice Directive 0501. We have the Planning and Analysis Department here and the state court administrator. The last person I know that ran that was Jessica Zender, Z-E-N-D-E-R. I don't believe they have anything but convictions, and I don't think we could have ever established that there were people that weren't charged with the habitual offender that were eligible for it. That type of stuff is only available either in the public defender or district attorney files. As to the consent and the eavesdropping, you have to read these statutes in paramateria. What does 18.9.305.4 mean if it says they must always get a court order? What does Section 16.15.101 mean when it says they must always get a court order? They can't just jump around the judiciary by just inserting one of their officers into the plea. And then finally, I'm not asking the court to find outrageous conduct. I'm just asking the court to say that the police must obey the law. 18.18 to 405 applies to them just as it does to Mr. Haley. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. A written opinion will